enacted and that Congress never considered, but claiming that Congress had it considered these problems that the agency now purports to have identified would have wanted it to be this way. And below, we have a district court that very uncritically just sort of looked at what the agency had done, and even though a lot of these things weren't in the statute, just simply accepted that they were matters of good policy and that the law should be this way. But that is just not the way law is made. Now, we acknowledge that this is a highly technical, complex case that requires a lot of understanding not only of federal gun law, but also some understanding of firearms themselves. And it might be tempting to just sort of assume that the agency with expertise and knowledge on the subject matter has gotten things right. And I suspect that the agency might get up here today and ask the court to simply trust that they understand the way these things work. But that would be a major mistake, we submit, that there are mistakes in this final rule that are not just wrong, but they are embarrassingly wrong. And I would like to just sort of highlight a few of those today, because this is just a voluminous final rule. But the first thing that I'd like to talk about is weapon parts kits and this idea that the agency admits that these collections of parts do not have a frame or receiver, which is required to be a firearm, but nevertheless somehow constitute a firearm. And on the theory that now ATF has put forward, firearms do not have to have frames or receivers. And they say this actually three times in their brief. I'm reading from page 24. Nowhere does the act or the common sense definition of weapon suggest any requirement that the weapon include a frame or receiver. Reading such a requirement into the statute would undermine Congress's intent. That's not Congress's intent. That is in the statute. The statute that defines a firearm says it's either a weapon or the frame or receiver of a weapon. It talks about where you mark a firearm on the frame or receiver of a weapon. The whole purpose of the Gun Control Act was to move away from regulating all gun parts.
So the statute doesn't define frame or receiver.
That is correct.
Why doesn't ATF get some, you know, Chevron deference or something along those lines in defining those things?
As the Vanderstock Court said, recognized in Texas, they are taking items that they just admitted are not frames and receivers, a kit that does not have a finished frame or receiver, but using this concept of readily, that even if it's not finished, even if it's not complete, even if we otherwise wouldn't regulate it, the idea that you can finish it into a firearm makes it a frame or receiver.
Did you say you think the statute defines firearm to include a frame or receiver?
Subsection A says a weapon. Subsection B says the frame or receiver of any such weapon.
The frame or receiver is a firearm.
The frame or receiver itself is a firearm, correct.
But a firearm is also a any weapon.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Those are separate.
Separate things.
Separate meanings of firearm.
They are.
Okay.
And so I mean, we know that firearms have frames and receivers, but here ATF is saying that they do not have frames and receivers if they are in a weapons parts kit. On the other hand, we have silencers, which the final rule now claims silencers have frames or receivers. No one has ever thought this until now. In fact, we have ATF for decades. Back in 1985, we have a letter that I'm not sure they knew they wrote, but it says a silencer does not have a frame or receiver. But now, 90 years later, after the National Firearms was passed, now they do have frames or receivers. So we're left in this weird situation where guns that we all know have frames or receivers don't, where silencers that no one ever thought did, do, and it makes absolutely no sense. ATF wants to codify this classification system that they have where you send us a product, a sample, we will give you back a letter and tell you what we think this thing is. And in that part of the regulation, ATF says no one else can rely on these letters except the specific person to whom the letter is addressed and with respect to no other firearm other than the specific sample that was submitted. But if you look elsewhere in the final rule, when it comes to defining what a frame or receiver is, ATF says, well, our definition doesn't apply to everything because we've been making it up for years, and so we can't write a definition that encompasses all firearms. So go back to our classification letters that we'd issued in the past, and everyone can rely on those. They just said no one can rely on those. And now they say you can rely on them not just for the particular make model of firearm that was submitted, but for variants thereof. So they're speaking out of both sides of their mouth. Both of these things cannot simultaneously be true, but they're both in the same rulemaking.
Well, let's go back. I'd like to go back to Judge Grunder's question. The statute doesn't define a frame or receiver. So would you disagree that the that the government can, through regulation, give a definition?
I think they could. They have given a definition back in 1970. It never worked, and they are trying to update.
So they're trying to update the definition. So we all agree that that's okay to do that.
If they do something that
but you don't like the update.
That's
so that becomes the question: is the update so out of the bounds of rational government rulemaking that we should enter an injunction on a temporary basis? Is what you're saying?
And I'll give you an example here. There was a letter that ATF issued about a month before the proposed rule was promulgated, and someone sent in, and you can't make this stuff up, a metal water bottle like I have on the table there, and said, can you classify this? Because here's the instructions. I think I could take this water bottle, turn it into a frame or receiver, add some other parts, and turn it into a firearm. Can you tell me what this metal water bottle is? And you would think this would be an easy question, but the agency actually wrote back, this is Exhibit 42 in our complaint, and they used the same principles that are in the final rule, that an incomplete frame receiver, if it can be readily converted to one, is, if a weapons parts kit, other parts can be added, could be a firearm. And they conclude in that letter that a metal water bottle might actually be a firearm under the Gun Control Act, and in fact might be a machine gun under the National Firearms Act, and they can't say for sure. And that was the letter that ATF wrote applying the principles in this final rule. Similarly, the plastic water bottle that my co-counsel has on the table, ATF says a silencer, which the statute says has to be designed and intended for a specific purpose, it has to be for use, either a part combination of parts, it has to be for something. ATF says the final rule says that a silencer is now just contains all the parts necessary to function. Well, if you took a plastic water bottle and slid it over the end of a barrel of a firearm, wrapped a couple rolls of tape around, you have all the parts necessary to function as a silencer simply by pulling the trigger. So they remove all of the mens rea type of concepts from the statute. And so we have plastic water bottles or silencers, metal water bottles or machine guns. You can rely on our letters. You can't rely on our letters. This is what the Supreme Court, I think, had in mind just a couple weeks ago in Bittner v. United States, says, when the government speaks out of both sides of its mouth, no one should be surprised if its latest utterance isn't the most convincing one. These are just examples of what happens when a decision is made to order bureaucrats, regulators, to enact a political decision that Congress considered did not enact in recent legislation, regardless of what the law says, regardless of what the past 50 years of agency precedent say, and irrespective of any technical precision. But as the judge in the Vanderstock case recognized, these are criminal statutes, precision is required. And he said, precise wording demands precise application. And I see I'm already eating into my rebuttal, so if I can reserve the rest of my time.
You have any more questions?
No.
Okay, very well. Why don't you save the balance for rebuttal? Thank you. Ms. Smith-Gall, we'll hear from you next.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kathleen Smith-Gall, and I represent the state of Montana and the Coalition of Appellant States. As Mr. Olson already explained, the ATF's final rule presents several key problems. For the next few minutes, I'd like to focus on the logical outgrowth test and then the gun registry argument that we raised in our briefing. So I'd first like to turn to the procedural issues with the rule. And I'll first highlight the differences in the proposed definition of frame and receiver, and then the final definition. And then I'll talk about how that, based on other examples in other courts, this final rule is not a logical outgrowth of what the agency proposed. So the several key differences worth mentioning is, you know, the proposed definition here encompassed any housing structure for any fire control component. The final decision only described a single specific housing or structure for one specific type of fire control component. So the proposed rule envisioned, you know, defined numerous different parts as frames and receivers, but the final rule at least attempted to make it so that one specific part of every firearm is a frame and receiver. The proposed definition provided four enumerated examples of frames and receivers. The final rule added six additional ones that people were not able to comment on. And then the proposed rule defined frame and receiver as one term. The final rule broke that out into separate frame and receiver definitions. And taken together, these differences show that the final rule was not a logical outgrowth of the proposed rule and that the public didn't have fair notice to be able to comment on the final rule as written by the agency. And to satisfy the logical outgrowth test, we always talk about fair notice. And what this means is that the public was on notice of the particular changes that the agency was considering making, that those changes were reasonably foreseeable and in character with the original proposal. Of course, this all gives the public an opportunity to meaningfully comment on every important component of the final rule. And this court has said that simple notice of the subjects and issues involved is not sufficient notice and doesn't satisfy the logical outgrowth test. And the district court here didn't grapple with what that test actually requires, and instead concluded that simply because the final rule was somehow narrower than the proposed rule, that satisfied the logical outgrowth test. But again, we talk about fair notice, and the standard is whether the parties, the public, was able to comment on the particular changes that the agency was considering. And as I mentioned earlier, simply notifying the public that the agency was considering altering the definition broadly is not sufficient notice for the public to be able to comment on these specific changes that were made.
Well, there must be some middle ground, though, because when you keep saying they couldn't comment on the specific changes that were made, that would mean that the agency can't change the rule at all.
So, Your Honor,
unless it gives alternatives in the notice. Your proposed standard there would mean they can't modify it in response to comments. So there must be some middle ground here.
Yes, Your Honor, and we're certainly not advocating for some sort of Goldilocks moment where, you know, the agency either has to, you know, can't change too much but also can't change too little. But the logical outgrowth test is a spectrum of possibilities for the agency, of course, as you noted, to respond to comments. And here we have kind of two extremes. We have this initial proposed rule that is envisioning all sorts. I mean, in the complaint, we talked about how firearms would have upwards of 10, 15 frames or receivers in it. And then we have the final rule where the agency says, actually, we're redefining this theory of what constitutes a frame and receiver, and each firearm should only have one. This court, I'd point the court to the Citizens Telecommunications case. And in that case, kind of the key takeaway is that the agency, if the agency is going to change the underlying theory, then that wouldn't satisfy the logical outgrowth test. In that case, the agency proposed a rule that was largely viewed as regulatory, and then it ended up in a place that was largely deregulatory. And of course, this was a kind of sea change on the theory underlying the proposal. Here, likewise, we have this idea that all these different parts can constitute a frame or receiver. We end up in a place that's much more narrow, very specific, again, with very specific examples. And in Citizens Telecommunications, likewise, there were the kind of issue was this, these business data services. And in the proposed rule, the agency defined these two different services, acknowledged that they were different, but treated them the same under the proposed rule. And in the final rule, broke those into two separate regulations. And similarly here, we see the agency treating frame and receiver the same in the proposed definition, and then treating them, breaking them out differently in the final definition. And so again, kind of all these changes together suggest that the agency did not satisfy the logical outgrowth test.
I want to make sure you address, before you finish your argument, the government's contention that the states lack standing. Now, if you're joined with the, it's not entirely clear whether you've actually joined the complaint. It's not. There's no amended complaint that adds the states. You filed your own separate complaint. Why do you have standing in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, because the states have, each of the states represented here has an interest in lowering crime and pursuing their own law enforcement policies. And this rule...
Is there a policy on the books of the state of Montana or any of the other states that says we want more citizens to have guns?
Not something that expressly, Your Honor, but each of these states has adopted a more guns, less crime approach to law enforcement and has passed very permissive laws for firearm manufacturers and individuals seeking to obtain manufacture firearms themselves. And so what this, the agency has said that Under this rule, there will be licensees that go out of business. Of course, their goal is to decrease circulations of certain firearms, and that contradicts our state policies. And again, law enforcement is something that's been left to the states, and so the states have standing for based on their sovereign interests and in lowering
those,
crime.
Aren't those harms pretty general and pretty indirect? It takes several steps of logic to get to that. To get to the harm caused by this, isn't it too general and too indirect to give you standing?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because again, we have the agency saying that they know. I mean, we know for a fact that this will put licensees. I think everyone here agrees that this will put certain licensees out of business. And the goal of this rule is to decrease circulation of certain firearms and their component parts.
That may give licensees standing. Because it's a kind of a direct harm there, but a pretty indirect to get to a harm to the state.
Well, and then from there, Your Honor, the states, the fact that there are fewer guns, again, contradicts the state's own permissive regulations, which are based on an idea that the more guns, the less crime. And again, the law enforcement structure being centered on that theory. And so the fact that there are now going to be fewer guns in circulation and fewer businesses is a harm to the states.
Why should we issue an injunction that's nationwide that impacts states who believe more guns means more crime? Why shouldn't we, assuming you're right, why won't we delimit it to the states that have that philosophy and not impose it on a state, which I assume would be Minnesota, for example, that believes that more guns means more crime?
Because, Your Honor, at the end of the day, the question we're trying to answer here is what is a firearm? And what that means imposes criminal liability. For if something is illegal in one state, under federal law, it has to be illegal in all the states. And so in this case, a nationwide injunction is...
But you're saying you want your philosophy imposed on the whole country. What if some states have a different philosophy?
Well, Your Honor, and I'd go back, so...
So that's
our basis for standing here. The reason why this law violates the APA, as I was saying, is because the final rule is not a logical outgrowth of the proposed rule. And so that the agency, regardless of whatever purported emergency exists or purported problem it's trying to solve, still has to follow a notice and comment rulemaking process. And so that's the problem.
Going back to that point, state again your concern about the change in the frame between the notice and the final rule. You said they changed from, can you articulate that one more time?
Yeah, so kind of three big changes. First, then the big one is that the proposed rule envisioned multiple, each firearm containing multiple parts. Then you have the one definition to two definitions. And then you have the idea that you also have the agency adding in numerous examples. You know, it went from 4 examples to 10 examples. Each of those examples, the agency saying this constitutes a frame or receiver. And the public was not on fair notice that the agency was considering any of those changes. And so it doesn't satisfy the logical outgrowth test.
Adding more examples wouldn't be a logical outgrowth.
Well, Your Honor, in context of the other changes as well, again, moving from this very broad definition to a very specific narrow definition. And what the district court said was that just the broad to narrow movement was sufficient. And while that may be the case in some circumstances, going from a very broad rule to a more narrow rule, this rule was just simply too broad, as was a lot of people commented on how broad the rule was. I see my time's expired, so unless you have further questions.
Any more questions, Judge? All right, very well. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Janda, we'll hear from you for the appellees.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Sean Janda for the federal government. I think it would be helpful to start this morning by just taking a step back to think about what the rule does and doesn't do. So the rule is not aimed at, and in fact does not prohibit, the possession, the buying, the selling, the assembly of any firearm by any licensee or by any person who can lawfully possess firearms. Instead, the rule is aimed at just ensuring the effective continued implementation of the Gun Control Act requirements that firearms be serialized, that they be sold following background checks, and that records be kept of their acquisition and disposition. And Congress has determined that those requirements are critical components of the nation's gun safety scheme. They prevent firearms from falling into the hands of those like felons who cannot lawfully possess them. And they ensure that when firearms are used in crimes, law enforcement has the ability to trace those firearms and try and solve the crime. And so the rule really is just aimed at those things. I think the district court properly understood the scope and the import of the rule in denying the request for a preliminary injunction. The district court correctly concluded that the rule fully comports with the statute and is reasonable and reasonably explained. The district court also independently and correctly concluded that the plaintiffs haven't shown any irreparable harm from the rule and that the balance of the equities and the public interest weigh against a preliminary injunction. Each of those findings is correct. Any provides a basis to affirm the district court's denial of a preliminary injunction.
So the new definition of firearm includes parts, right?
It includes an assemblage of parts that can be readily converted to an operational firearm. So not sort of individual barrels or stocks or whatever standing alone, but just as the rule says, kind of a weapon parts kit that taken together collectively enables one to assemble an operational firearm.
So all of the parts, if you buy a kit that is missing some sort of striking mechanism but has every other part, is that regulated or not?
So I think it would depend on the specifics of the kit, and ATF would have to make that determination. I don't want to say the kit has to have sort of every single individual part that if you have to provide your own single screw to finish the assembly that it's not covered. But I think the rule quite clearly is aimed at these kits that taken together with sort of all of these parts as one assembled object are firearms under the statute are designed to or may readily be converted to expel.
Let me set aside that issue, which I think is an interesting issue, but let me set that aside. Elsewhere in the statute, I think with respect to destructive devices, Congress used the word parts. Right?
Correct.
Doesn't their failure to do so with respect to defining firearms suggest that Congress knows how to include parts if they want to, and they didn't with respect to firearms, and therefore this exceeds the scope of the statute?
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think if you look at the other definitions in the statute that speak in terms of parts, they're generally aimed at allowing the regulation or requiring the regulation of individual parts. So the silencer definition, for example, includes any part that is intended for use only in fabricating or assembling a silencer. Here, ATF is not trying to regulate and is not regulating sort of every individual part of a gun, but only those assemblages of parts that are, as the rule says, sort of designed to readily assembled or converted into being operational firearms. And I think just as a conceptual matter, sort of stepping back, there's really no difference between a kit that sort of has all of the disassembled parts of a firearm and a firearm that has been assembled and disassembled. And as we explain in our briefs, there's ample precedent, including from this court, recognizing that disassembled firearms constitute firearms for purposes of the Gun Control Act's definition. And again, it just, I think, flows quite clearly from the plain text of the statute. A kit that has all of these parts is both designed to and may readily be converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive. And there might be sort of a hard edge case about a kit missing sort of a critical component or sort of a number of components that would not themselves be individually regulated. And so we recognize there are edge cases out there. The rule, obviously, an ATF provides a mechanism for trying to get clarity on those edge cases. But I don't think the presence of sort of some edge cases detracts from the fundamental understanding that a kit that does contain all those parts, that does allow the ready assembly of a firearm, it fits under the plain language of the statute.
Let me try a similar argument with respect to the serialization requirement. As I understand it, the statute provides that importers and manufacturers are required to include a serial number, but doesn't include dealers. And elsewhere in the statute, when Congress wants to include dealers, they include dealers. So isn't it beyond the scope of the statute to now require dealers to serialize these parts and kits and guns?
So I don't think so, Your Honor. And let me say two things about that. So first, just thinking about what Congress was intending to do or not do, I think when you read the statute, it seems like Congress probably thought they were covering most of the waterfront when it came to the serialization requirement, because how are firearms produced? They're either manufactured or they're imported. And there's no need to then require the dealer, who will generally be buying firearms from an importer or from a manufacturer who has already serialized the firearm, to add the serial number. And so I don't think there's some implication, and they certainly haven't pointed to any suggestion, more sort of explicit or direct suggestion, that Congress was intentionally excluding licensed dealers from that requirement. And then when it comes to the authority that the Attorney General and the ATF have employed to make the requirement here, I think there's two important sources of authority. So one is 18 U.S.C. 926A, which is the general authority to promulgate regulations that are necessary to implement the statute. And then the other comes in 923G, which provides more specific authority to implement, to promulgate record-keeping requirements. And there are sort of long-standing regulatory requirements. They're not challenged in this case, that dealers record as part of the record when they acquire or dispose of a firearm the serial number. It's, I think, in many ways the most important part of the record, because it's what allows the tracing of a firearm when it's recovered, for example, at a crime scene. And as the rule explains, that record-keeping requirement is just ineffective if there's no serial number for the dealer to record. And so all the rule does is say...
Well, the statute doesn't refer to recording a serial number, does it? That comes in a regulation, as I understand it.
That's correct, Your Honor. So the statute requires dealers, along with other licensed individuals, to make records and keep records sort of as the Attorney General shall prescribe in regulations. And the Attorney General has long required the use of a serial number, recording of a serial number. I think that...
But is that limited to cases in which the dealer's recording something that already exists?
So it is true, Your Honor.
Is there any other precedent? Is there any precedent, I should say, for asking the dealers to create new material that would then be recorded?
So this is a new requirement. I think the rule makes clear that there was not previously a requirement that dealers...
Well, I know the serial number thing is new, but I mean, is there any other example of...
I'm not aware of any other information that you just wouldn't have. I mean, the records, I think, generally require you to record sort of who you're acquiring the firearm from, who you're disposing of it to, and they require the serial number. And so, I mean, I think the serial number, I don't want to say this for sure, but I'm just not sure that there are a whole bunch of things in the record-keeping requirements that sort of could not exist the dealer would be required to create. And I think here, again, there's just the record-keeping... It is just totally ineffective if there's no serial number to record. And so the rule just requires that when a dealer is going to be making a record, when the dealer has taken the firearm into inventory, is going to have to record its acquisition and its disposition, that the dealer ensure that that record is effective.
Is the rule designed so that that would only come into play with respect to firearms that are already in existence and that going forward under the rule, the private makers would have to put a serial number on, or no?
No, Your Honor. So the rule does not require someone who makes a firearm for their own personal use to serialize it.
So you're concerned about, or the ATF is concerned about somebody who does that and then later transfers it to a dealer?
Right. So ATF
would not be covered by a license requirement, the transfer to the dealer.
So the transfer to the dealer... I think the real sort of issue is when the dealer, let me back up. So the statute imposes record keeping requirements that are then sort of fleshed out in regulations. Those record keeping requirements are on dealers and importers and manufacturers, on licensees, not on private individuals. So when the dealer acquires or disposes of a firearm, the dealer is required to make a record.
I'm just asking, how would a dealer get an unserialized firearm after this rule goes into effect from a private manufacturer who makes it for his own use and then later gives it to a dealer?
Correct. So a private manufacturer who, I mean, could sell it to a dealer or could bring it to a dealer for
repairs
or sort of other operations. Uh-huh. And if the dealer takes that firearm into its inventory as part of that process, which the dealer doesn't necessarily have to do, if the dealer can...
Not for repair, you wouldn't have to.
Right. I mean, as long as you can do the repair, sort of, you know, the day you get it, you do the repair, you hand it back. This requirement doesn't apply. It only applies if
If you have to keep it a week to do the repair, would that be taking it into inventory?
Yes. So the rule uses sort of an overnight requirement. Overnight. So if you, the dealer, are keeping custody of the firearm.
Then the dealer does have to serialize it.
Correct. Serialize it and you'll make a record of the acquisition disposition.
So let me make sure. So if they just take it in for repair, they have to serialize it? Is that what you just said?
If they keep it overnight.
Right. If they keep it overnight. So if you give it back. And I think the point here is that if someone comes in and gives you their firearm and you sort of repair it that afternoon and give it back, you haven't really taken custody of it. You haven't taken it into your inventory. If you keep it overnight, then it's part of your inventory and you have to record it and serialize it.
Does a manufacturer have to be licensed to transfer to a dealer for resale?
So a manufacturer has to be licensed to manufacture. So if you are engaged in the business of manufacturing firearms...
I mean, if you're just a private manufacturer.
No, so if you are...
your own use, but you decide later, I want to resell, I want to make some money off of this, so I'm going to take it down to a dealer to
So sell. My understanding, Your Honor, is that you can make firearms for your own use without being a licensed manufacturer. If you sort of do that sometimes, and you know every now and again you're selling one to a dealer... you likely are not covered by the statute. If you say,
okay, so
I'm going to sell one every day.
Yeah, every day you become a business.
Right. And the,
so if you're not covered, you do it every once in a while, then it would not have to be serialized by you, the maker.
Correct.
And the rule is designed to make the dealer then serialize it before he resells it.
Correct.
Is that right?
That is correct. And the statutory line there is if you are engaged in the business of manufacturing firearms.
Mr. Olson brought up the issue of silencers, and as I understand, the statute requires that there's an intent element in the statute that's absent from the regulation.
So I don't think that's quite correct, Your Honor. So the intent requirement is not explicit in the regulation, but the regulation, this is when the regulation is defining a complete muffler or silencer device, and the regulation says that a complete muffler or silencer device is two things. First, it's a muffler or silencer under the statute, so it incorporates the intent requirement. And then second, it's the complete thing. And so the statute, as I said before, defines a silencer to include not just the complete device, but also any part that is intended only for use in assembling or fabricating a silencer. And so in defining a complete device, which then certain regulatory requirements attach to, I think the rule is trying to say we're not talking about sort of individual parts, we're talking about the whole thing. And so, for example, the rule says that if you're selling a silencer part not as part of a complete device, you need to serialize that part. But if you're selling the complete device, you don't need to serialize each individual part. But the rule, as it incorporates the statutory definition, I think the district court understood that, got that right, and that's certainly ATF's understanding.
And so you serialize even if it's common household or hardware parts. If you go on the internet and find out that Mr. Olson used the example, you take a 2-liter bottle of Coke and cut off the end, put some duct tape around it. I'm assuming you can make a silencer that way. How does that work in this rule context?
Right. So I think the rule, as it incorporates the intent requirement. So if you have a 2-liter bottle of Coke sitting in your house and you have no intent to make that into a silencer, is not a silencer, is not a complete silencer device under the rule. It's just a 2-liter bottle of Coke. If you cut it up and wrap tape around it and fashion it into a thing that you are intending to use as a silencer, I think you've created a silencer. And there are sort of regulatory requirements that attach to that that you would have to comply with.
And Ms. Smith-Gall, I think, was going to talk about this before she ran out of time. Why is the requirement that you keep records in perpetuity and then turn them over to the government at the end not a national registry? It just seems like that is a logical conclusion to that requirement.
So I think sort of for three reasons, Your Honor. So first is just in sort of a formal way, the statute prohibits any new regulation that requires turning over records to the government. Here, the rule doesn't require turning over records to the government. That's a separate statutory requirement. The rule just extends the time that you have to keep records. And sort of second, the same Congress that enacted the restriction on a registry in the very same statute also enacted the requirement that licensees turn over their records to the government when they go out of business or when they stop sort of licensed activity. And so I think sort of whatever Congress meant by national gun registry, they couldn't have meant that requirement because they enacted both at the same time. And then the third thing, which I think is really important, is just when you think about sort of in common parlance what a registry is, it's not this. You know, nothing in the rule or in the underlying statute requires sort of the entry of records as they're created. Nothing requires sort of centralization in the government of all these records. Licensees, as long as they're engaged in the business that they're licensed for, keep custody of their own records, that they are not turning them over to the government. They're not creating sort of a central database of all these records. But I think the important thing here, again, is that, sort of for all those reasons, I don't think the rule violates the statute. And I think it's important to appreciate that requiring the preservation of records when a licensee goes out of business is, I think, as reflected by the statutory requirement, a really important part of enabling the tracing of firearms. Firearms, when they're serialized, the serial number points you back to the person who serialized it originally, often a manufacturer. And so you then sort of have to trace the firearm forward in time through the records. And so if sort of records from a licensee that went out of business aren't preserved, then the trail just goes cold. There's a missing link, and the government often is not able at that point to trace the firearm forward to whoever sort of is supposed to have possession of it today. If there are no other questions.
Well, with regard to 923I and the serialization requirement on importers and manufacturers, you said, I believe you said earlier, Congress thought it was capturing most, if not all, firearms in that section. But was there such a thing as privately made firearms in 1968 or whenever the Gun Control Act was, when 923I was passed?
So I don't want to say that they didn't exist. That being said, I think the rule makes clear that there's been a very, very large uptick or proliferation of privately made firearms in recent years as technological advances have enabled these sorts of kits and sort of DIY home assembly firearms.
So the idea is they thought that it was a de minimis, that would be your view, that it was de minimis at the time and now it's increased?
I think that's correct. And I don't think there's anything, as I said, in the statute that reflects an intent sort of not to apply that, not to have dealers subject to serialization requirements that the Attorney General might prescribe.
But is that the test, whether they intended not to, or is the test whether they authorize the Attorney General to?
Right. So I think there's two different pieces of this argument, Your Honor. So one is in response to the argument that sort of Congress implicitly precluded this requirement through 923I.
Oh, you mean the exclusio unius argument?
Right. I don't think that's correct because I don't think Congress was thinking about this. Separately, as we've explained, the Attorney General has authority to promulgate this requirement through a combination of the 926A and the 923G authority that provides both specific authority to promulgate record-keeping requirements and more general authority to promulgate regulations that are necessary to implement the statutory requirements. And I think this is...
Do you have anything you want to say about irreparable harm?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just doesn't exist here. As we've explained in the brief, all the harms that the other side is pointing to are either sort of compliance costs, which may well exist, but are not irreparable. They're not the sort of, as this court said...
Do you have any Eighth Circuit cases that say that?
Not directly, Your Honor. I mean, I think the best case is Iowa Utilities Board, which describes the sort of harm that's required to support a preliminary injunction as harm that is so sort of certain and great and imminent that it really calls out for the exercise of equitable discretion to remedy it. And I think ordinary compliance costs just don't fit the bill. We have the Second Circuit case that we cite in our briefs, Spitzer, that I think is very directly on point, but that follows
even
from...
Even if they're not recoverable, the Second Circuit says...
Correct. I think that case, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was a suit against New York and the state of New York, which has sovereign immunity like the federal government. And I think any other rule, just to quickly say, would be very strange because it would put the federal government and the states at a unique disadvantage to all other litigants because of sovereign immunity, which just doesn't, I don't think, make a ton of sense. I think that, as we said before, the harms to the states that they articulate are just some combination of indirect and speculative and intangible.
All right.
else? All right. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, we'll hear from you in rebuttal. Why don't you put 2 minutes on, please? We'll round out your rebuttal time.
I appreciate it.
There's Judge, a lot to cover in the case.
There is a lot to cover, Your Honor.
And, Go ahead. Just start it from there, man.
Try to do it as quickly as I can. Judge Molloy, you had asked about a nationwide injunction. And I know courts don't always like this, but under the APA it says set aside the agency action that's unlawful. And I think you either set it aside or you don't. But also, more fundamentally, we're representing gun owners of America. We have 2 million people nationwide who support us in probably every zip code in the United States. Now, if that requires us to go back to the district court and show how we have someone in every state that is affected by this, we're prepared to do that. But I think that when you have a group like this, who have people everywhere who are affected by this, an injunction should apply everywhere. Judge Mueller, you asked, and I wanted to be clear, because you mentioned not that ATF couldn't enact a regulation, but that we disagree with or dislike it. And it's not just that we dislike it, it's that it violates the statute. And I'll give you another example, and it's with this concept of readily applied to unfinished frame receivers, where they take words from one part of the statute and put it in another. And we point out ATF has never used the concept of readily looking at an unfinished frame receiver, and they disagree. They say, we've always used the concept of readily. That's implicit in all of our classification letters for years. But a month before the NPRM, once again, was promulgated, they were in federal district court arguing that they had never, this is from their brief, we have never used the amount of time to finish a frame receiver. Yet amount of time is the first factor in this test that they now proposed. And if it's the same test, if they've always used this test, why is everything changing? Why are all the items that didn't used to be guns suddenly now firearms, all the classification letters that they've issued in the past suddenly now rescinded? And if it's a different test, like we say, under the APA, they haven't acknowledged that they're shifting policy, that they used to have a policy that was bad, and now they have a new policy that is good, and explain why the old one's bad, why the new one is good. Government counsel mentioned all the cases that deal with disassembled firearms, and how all the courts all across America have held that if you have a collection of parts that's just disassembled, it's still a firearm. We deal with that in the complaint. There's like 25 of these cases. Every single one has a frame or receiver. And a weapons part kit here does not have a frame or receiver, and the ATF admits as much.
What's the status of the Texas case? Do you know?
It is ongoing. There was a preliminary injunction issued. It is not as broad as this case. It doesn't challenge as many aspects of the final rule.
Injunction was not nationwide.
It was not nationwide. It was
appeal.
It is currently pending in the district court, I believe. There have been other parties who have come in and intervened to try to get right within the umbrella of the injunction.
Whether the government has appealed the injunction. Do you know?
I don't know the answer
to
that
Mr.
question.
Do you know, Mr.
Janda? Yes, the government has appealed and it's fully briefed in the circuit.
Fully briefed but not argued? Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Olson. You're out of time. But
I see my time is up, but we'd ask that you reverse the district court and enjoin the final.
I may ask a couple, with your indulgence. You're not arguing that this new rule violates the Second Amendment. As I understand your argument, it's just that they failed to consider the Second Amendment in promulgating this rule.
Well, we have brought that claim, and we are making that argument. We did not brief it in the preliminary injunction motion, so it's...
Nor on appeal to us. So that issue is not in front of us.
It isn't, other than that it is because we have the APA problem that they failed to consider Bruin and the true meaning of the Second Amendment. They used this bogus test.
My second question, I'm trying to keep this quick. With respect to irreparable harm, given that they're still allowed to buy and sell part kits and so forth, the only potentially irreparable harm that I see is what Mr. Olson referred to with respect to the requiring dealers to serialize. Do you have any cases that say compliance costs alone are sufficient?
Not in the Eighth Circuit. In the Fifth Circuit, there is. And I completely disagree. The compliance cost is the only thing at issue here. We have a private plaintiff who can't acquire the parts that he needs to manufacture his own firearms. He can't get his guns serviced at a dealer, even painted. This is not a process that takes 4 hours. It's a process that takes days. And he wants to go to an FFL and have this done. The FFL doesn't have the capability to serialize a gun, so they have to ship it off to Fargo, North Dakota, and it's got to go by FedEx overnight. That's $30, $40. It's got to go to another dealer who then has to take it onto its books who can
serialize. Presumably, if this gets promulgated, they're going to buy equipment to serialize, right?
That's expensive equipment, Your Honor. It costs thousands and thousands of dollars. I don't know that every...
Well, I said that's the potential one that I see, but I'm not seeing a lot elsewise because they can still buy and sell part kits.
Do they have to get a license?
They do have to get a license. They have to engage in all the record keeping, all the liabilities and requirements that come along with that. But we represent industry members who, even if they're licensed, don't need a license to manufacture and sell these products for the last decade, 2 decades, 3 decades. These companies have laid off employees. They have lost huge amounts. Sometimes we've talked 70, 80, 90% of their revenue. One company we talked to is already going out of business. They said, we can't continue because this is what we sell, and it doesn't make sense to simply continue.
All right. I think you've answered the irreparable harm
thank
question.
You.
Unless you have any...
No. Okay. Thank you.
Mike? All right. Very well. Thank you for your argument. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will file a decision in due course. Please call the next case for argument.
Yes, Your Honor. The third case for argument